managers is, like most ecologists, I'm a real newcomer to sensor networks. I think all of us have been kind of learning together, so it's really a great opportunity to come here and learn a lot from people who've thought about these issues for a lot longer than we have. What I want to talk about today is a relatively new project, collaboration involving myself as an ecologist, Alan, who's going to talk next, statistician, a number of computer scientists, and an engineer, Paul Flickema from NAU, who developed the system, is developing the system that we're working on. And some of the ideas we've thought about on how to actually control the measurement process, and given that we're trying to draw inference on ecosystems. Well, the sort of the motivation here is that we're dealing with very complicated problems. You think about the issues that you hear about in the news, things like global change, CO2 in the atmosphere is rising, plants are responding directly to that. The climate is changing, which of course affects rates, growth rates, mortality rates, all kinds of processes that affect organisms. It's happening on a lot of scales, it's spatial, it's temporal. There's a lot of different types of interactions. And the data, the kind of information we have is pretty complicated. So we were sort of coming, or at least myself as an ecologist was coming from this background, just to give you a little bit of a sense for the kind of information we have to deal with. This is just kind of a sampling, but the upper left is an example of where we fumigate forests with CO2. So we've got sort of plot scale data. We shoot out CO2 into the environment and see how that elevated CO2 affects all kinds of factors affecting the growth, photosynthetic rates, respiration, demography of plants. At the lower left, we have experimental hurricanes. We pull down the forest and look at the responses in the understory. How does this affect conditions in the environment? How does that in turn affect population dynamics? We get data remotely from remote sensing and all the way down to just individual observations on individual organisms. So it's really a pretty complicated set of information.
Yeah. When that CO2 injection or whatever, is it at levels that you're projecting might be realistic down the road, or are they really heavy doses of extreme levels?
No, it's kind of on the minimal side. What we do is we increase ambient levels. So ambient levels now are about 375 ppm. We increase the ambient level in the fumigated rings 250 ppm above that, which of course is quite a bit less than the double CO2 scenarios that you're used to hearing about. So it's actually pretty modest. I guess as an ecologist too, at least when you think about remote sensing data, but really any sort of sensor data, usually what we think about as data are actually pretty highly processed. We're dealing with things that are like voltage drop across some instrument, then that somehow turns into something we call data. But you can sort of extend to this to the point where an awful lot of the information that we sort of view as data is really model output. So it sort of predisposes you to start thinking about not raw data so much, but you need to be able to use information that might come from a lot of sources. And just like data, models have bias, they have uncertainty. So all of these kinds of information we have to be able to assimilate. Well, one of the things we've been able to do is to build big ugly models that can capture a lot of these interactions and also assimilate a lot of different types of information. So this is not actually a model graph, but it's kind of a simplification. But this whole upper layer is just different types of information coming in at many different scales, and this could include wireless data. This is the only thing that's known in this model, is this upper level. At the underlying process stage, the processes are all stochastic, so we can admit many different types of correlated data. Obviously, there's a lot of different kinds of information that's going to come in. It's all highly correlated with each other. If it wasn't, you'd be concerned about that. So we model the processes. We're drawing inference on the processes themselves at sort of these lower stages. And then we want to bring in different types of structure as well down to parameter stages and so forth. So we've got tools we can use to see a lot about the environment. I want to just give you a couple of examples of what this has helped us to do. We have forests now where we can look at any particular tree. This happens to be a tree that's about 45 centimeters in diameter. Over the last 15 years, we can estimate how much seed has been produced every year, even though we can't see this. We can't count seeds on a tree, but using sort of the interactions, the relationships between fecundity and things like growth rates, some things that we can observe, like seeds that accumulate in traps, when we put all the information together, we can come up with estimates of a lot of detail. We can actually learn about demography of whole populations. If we're not interested in every individual, which are shown here by these little short lines, we can come up with population summaries, things like what is the effect of just variation year to year, things like masting, how much variation is there among individuals, and how much leftover process error is there. Again, these are things that we can't actually observe, but by putting together everything we can, all the information we can obtain, we can learn a lot about these systems. One of the big issues in ecology when we think about diversity is how come some species don't just drive other species to extinction? Why is it that some species might have an advantage in some cases and not in others? Here again are hidden relationships that we can expose this way. We can't see how much light is available to a big tree. We also can't see how many seeds it produces. But when we bring together a lot of different types of information, we can model it. So these are all estimates of latent states. And here we can clearly see that two different species at low light, one produces more seed, at high light, another species produces seed. So again, these are powerful tools we can use to bring together information and draw some pretty powerful inferences. We came into this wireless problem, I guess, sort of with this modeling background, and started to think about how we could actually do this efficiently, collect data efficiently from wireless networks. Given the fact that we've got a lot of stuff going on, it's going to be at many different scales, and I'll really talk about a lot of the same issues that we've already heard about today, and maybe just put more of an ecosystem slant on it. The kinds of models that we want to run from these types of data, you could sort of start at the top with physiology. We've got individual trees that are going to respond to the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere, temperature, soil moisture, and so forth. They're going to have photosynthetic rates, respiration rates, that's in turn going to affect the atmosphere. We might care specifically about what that effect is and not be quite so interested in what individual trees are doing. Alternatively, we might be interested in just how does that play out in terms of the kinds of species that can coexist in environments. So you can think about an individual tree response, taking in, capturing light, fixing CO2, blowing off water vapor and CO and oxygen, that should be. Well, there's also CO2 coming off at night. We're taking water out of the ground that's going to sort of drive this whole process, and that in turn is going to affect nutrient cycles. These are pretty fast processes, and they operate at fine scales because they're things like individual leaves that are engaged in these processes. A lot of interest in things like climate change. So these processes at relatively fine scales, we might not want all these details, may affect what's going on in a much broader spatial scale. So the atmosphere is one that operates on pretty fast scales, but spatially is quite broad. So you can change the weather in a large region over a fairly short amount of time. Biodiversity sort of takes us in the other direction. We start to want to know how these responses to the atmosphere, how they differ among species, affect demographic rates, which in turn determine whether or not a species can survive. And that may also have some broad-scale implications in terms of where on the landscape will we have populations surviving once we change the climate and CO2. The kinds of variables that go into these models, there's now sensors, of course, for most of these variables, or at least sensors of variables that are pretty closely related to them. So we can think about starting to model these processes based on sensor networks. The system that we're using this again is one developed by Paul Flickema. It's a self-organizing network. At the moment, we've got several types of sensors that are listed here that we're that are in the network now. We have a tower above the forest. We've got three networks in one tower that collects information on the atmosphere. The goal of what I'm going to describe here is to try to minimize the amount of processing we're doing in the network, and also recognizing that for us, transmission is really expensive. These are in remote sites. We don't have access to power, so sending information is a big deal. Of course, we're excited about the same things that we've heard a lot about today already. The great thing about these sensor networks is you could just collect everything. That's what makes them powerful. You know, you could look at scales of seconds up to hours and accumulate huge amounts of information. There are processes that really need that type of information. After all, if it wasn't for the capacity to do that, we wouldn't put them out there. On the other hand, of course, then with the transmission issues, we have to recognize that the vast majority of that information would be essentially worthless. So we need to find out some way to really optimize how we collect data. So again, a number of issues we've talked a lot about already over the last 2 days. We wanted to understand what an observation is really worth to us. We wanted to do that in the context of models. So we don't want to think about just how much better is our estimate of a mean if we keep this observation, but rather how much learning is going to go on inside a model. There's going to be multiple models that are going to use these data. We're going to put up a platform like this, and it's not just energy balance models that are going to want to make use of that data. It's going to be many different types of models. So we need some sort of answer that recognizes that it's expensive to send this stuff. We want the learning to be quantified in the context of the models that are going to use it. We don't want to do a whole lot of processing in the network, and we don't want to use a whole lot of global information for local processing. We want to use mostly local information. But we do have the capacity to do a lot of work outside the network, and we want to make use of the capacity to send that into the network, at least periodically, even though we don't want to do it often. Well, ecosystem data is a real mix of scales, and I just wanted to give you kind of a sense of the processes. We have, you know, things that change very slowly. So on the upper graph here, I've just plotted soil moisture, and you can notice there's some activity there, particularly after it rains, but most of the time there's not much going on. We have some other types of variables. This is light in the understory. The amount of light that's coming into different sensors at different nodes, of course, there's not much at all at nighttime. In the daytime, it varies among nodes depending on the local canopy, but it's pretty predictable over long periods of time. Some things are much less predictable, and things like relative humidity have sort of an intermediate, you know, scale. You can see day and nighttime here for sure. But other than that, there's a lot going on there that it would be much harder to predict. So we've really got a lot of different scales of information that we have to think about when we think about this measurement process. Well, I mentioned that you know, the value of this is collecting fine scale information. And here again is just a couple of nodes where we're collecting understory light levels. But you can notice in these observations are here just indicated by these circles. An awful lot of the data are the observations are really contributing nothing. And also, even the ones that, for example, are in the daytime, an awful lot of this variation is predictable based on what happened at this location the day before and what's going on right now above the canopy. So essentially, if you knew how much light was at this site yesterday, and you know how much light is above the canopy now, you essentially don't need to record anything. A model can do that for you. And of course, we've got to remember that there's going to be a number of different models that are going to use this information. the scales for these models are really going to vary. What's important for one model is not going to be the same as what's important for another model. We really need information at this scale to calculate water, CO2, and energy balances. We have to have something like minutes to half hour scale data. That's the only way you can approach this problem. Someone else who's interested in biodiversity is going to be much more interested in things like seasonal scale droughts. How intense, how long does this persist? We have here plotted soil moisture. Germination responses to those types of droughts vary among species. Those sensitivities vary or differ from survivorship. Again, in this case, the lower panels are soil moisture. As you get more soil moisture, it's easier to survive. That varies among species. Higher germination potential varies among species. So a very different scale of information is needed for a different type of model. Growth rates of trees. Some species, at least on an annual basis, here's red maple that seems to follow pretty closely a drought index. When you look at things like the oaks have much less sensitive to it. So again, different demographic rates, different species are going to respond to different variables. So how do we start to think about collecting information at the right scales, right variables that are going to help us to learn about these responses? And there's different things about the data that we can exploit. So I mentioned already the fact that if we know what's going on at a particular node yesterday, we know an awful lot about what's going on today. So there's certain sort of local redundancies that we can exploit. If it's raining today, that tells us a lot about how much soil moisture we're going to have the next day. So do we need a whole lot of information from both of these variables over time? That's going to affect how cloudy it is and how much light is coming in. So those are relationships we want to be able to use. And we can often model data. Now, this is not a wireless example, but it's the same sort of problem. Here we're looking at the growth rates of a tree over time. Again, we're going to model the process stochastically so we can admit correlated data. This happens to be data that you can either get from measuring increment cores in trees. You can look at how wide those increments are year to year. You can also go out periodically and just measure the size of a tree. By using borrowing information across the whole population over time within individuals, we can model these data and think about the data, which are sort of predictive means and variances, posteriors, being much more informative than the actual observations themselves. So here we've measured the size of this tree at different years. There's some big gaps. Here's an individual with only one measurement in the last 15 years. We can put that information together with increment core data, and the more information we have, the tighter our confidence intervals, our credible intervals, and so forth. So we can model data from very sparse information. So when you sort of put this all together, we have the fact that an awful lot of these observations aren't going to tell us much. We can often use the model to stand in for observations, and we're going to need different kinds of data, different needs. We're going to learn in different ways based on the models that we're using. So our approach that we're working on, and this is very much in progress, is as follows. We want to take the inferential modeling and do it out of the network. So we model these with hierarchical models, the Bayesian. There's going to be a number of variables that go into these models. They're going to come from the full network. You can't really do this at a particular node because it takes too long to actually run the model. You can't run the model faster than the data are arriving. But we can use inferential modeling that's going on out of the network to feed back into the network in terms of what our best estimates of parameters are, state variables. And then we want to use some simple rules in the network to actually decide what to transmit. And the approach there, again, is to just use local information to the extent possible and very simplified, pared-down models based on the most recent information coming from the gateway to decide whether or not we should keep an estimate or not. And the approach that I'll talk a little bit about is whether or not the prediction exceeds some the difference between the model prediction and the observation exceeds some threshold. So there's really this the second option is the one that I just mentioned here. We can look at what do we observe at the jth node at time t, how does that compare with what the model would predict. If it's low enough, we don't need to transmit that observation. Another alternative is to just look and see if that observation has changed from the one that you observed last time. So I did this yesterday. I put together an example, just kind of thinking about we're doing this in sort of a more sophisticated scale, but I didn't have a real simple example. So what I did was I just put together an example to talk about here, and essentially what this does is it takes the network data as an underlying set of processes. These interact, and we've got different types of data coming in, and I just wanted to give you a sense for how we're approaching this. I'll show you a simulation from of soil moisture. The simulated data assumes that there's an underlying process. We don't know the parameters for that process. We'll simulate some data from that process. So we've got this process going along. It's going to generate data. We have a way of calibrating these data. We have, it's called TDR. It's a method where you can go out periodically and look at the soil moisture using something that's independent from the network. I've simulated 5 sensors. They each have error. They also drift. We don't know what the error and the drift is. The calibration data are sparse because we're only going to go out every few weeks and do that. The sensor data are dense, but they have all kinds of problems with them. We're going to estimate the unknown parameters in the process itself. Then we'll use the estimates to update the sensors and set a threshold, and then ask how much of the data did we actually need to send. So again, this is just a simple model. It says soil moisture at time t is some function with log normal error. It depends on what the soil moisture was the last time you measured it, precipitation, evapotranspiration with some parameters, drainage with some parameters. We've got sensors. So the jth sensor has some error. It's centered on the true process. It's got some drift that increases with time since you last calibrated the sensor. It's got some error. There's going to be random effects in this model for the drift. We're just going to treat them as exchangeable. We've got calibration data, which are unbiased, and they have known error because we calibrate. We can take this instrument and go out and use it over and over again and find out what this error is. We want to draw inference then based on the sensor network data, the calibration data, precipitation data. We want to draw inference on all of the states, all of the unknown parameters, the process parameters, the drift, and all of the errors, and then see if we can use that to just pare down on the amount of information that we need to transmit out of the network. So here's an example run in the upper panel. The thick solid line is the underlying truth. That's what's really going on out there. We've got these red dots are the calibration data, and you'll notice they only sort of show up every 20th iteration or so. And again, this is kind of an arbitrary design. You could imagine many other ways to do this. We've got different sensors, and you can notice how they're drifting over time. They're just different colors. Each has its own color. And the spread out here is quite a bit higher than it is back at the beginning. I just arbitrarily just shut down the network and collected no sensor data for a time here, although we still had precipitation data there. Again, we could use any assumptions you want here. And the underlying estimates of the truth are these dashed lines. You can't see them very well, but they do a very good job of estimating the amount of soil moisture that's in the soil. But of course, we had to run a Gibbs sample to do this, so it would take a little while to converge. And I just had my little Mac here that I did this in R, and I only ran this a few thousand iterations, so it certainly hasn't converged yet. But so it's kind of a crude result. And it doesn't fit very well, though, when you come to the parameters. So even though we can do a pretty good job on the states, the parameters themselves don't do very well. Here are the drift parameters for these five sensors, just given different colors, the same colors as up here. The true parameter values used to simulate the data are the dashed lines. Posteriors are here. It's estimating some bias there. Not doing a very good job of it, but at least it's got the order right. And there's some process parameters. Fits are also pretty crummy. Here's the real field capacity. Here's the real wilting point. Here's another constant in the model. The posteriors, again, are not doing a very good job. Of course, we could do better probably if we let this converge, but just to kind of give you a sense for what's going on. Even with a lousy fit, it turns out that the model says I can still predict the data well enough to send very little. And so what I've shown in the bottom plot here is, again, we're going to feed these sensors the estimates that we got out of fitting the model, right? So they're not even right. They're off. The probability of the true value is essentially zero in these posteriors. So they're really crummy estimates, but, they're in the ballpark. And then we're going to let the individual nodes just do a simple update, just a simple linear point calculation. What do I predict the next time, given what I have now, and parameters that were fed into the network up to 100 time steps ago? And what it says is that for soil moisture, I could essentially transmit nothing for most of this series. So the times when we actually transmitted, different nodes transmitted observations, are these dots. And because of the way I set the error threshold, it's not a percent, it's actually an absolute amount. So essentially the error is higher when the values are higher. It's saying we got to send a bunch here, we got to send a bunch here. And why it's sending more as we get to the end of this series is because as the drift accumulates over time, it just doesn't do a good job of predicting anymore. And so it has to keep sending more data. So you can sort of see here that you can really cut down on the amount of information you send simply because you're using the model instead of the data. So the model could really drastically reduce the amount of information that data we have to send through the network. So then to summarize, the approach we're taking is taking a series of different types of ecosystem models, ones from sort of carbon, energy, water, that operate on fast time scales over broad spatial scales, turning them into inferential models, thinking about what sorts of errors we can tolerate for different variables in different models, putting together simplified versions of those that can run in the network, essentially just linearized point prediction versions of those models, and then feeding in information from out of the network as we learn more about those variables. So you can think about this sort of point where you're going to learn a lot about parameters, you're going to send a lot of information, but get to the point where you can really just pare down the amount of information you send to those observations that you're going to really learn a lot. So that's all I've got.